This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Daniel Rave, who is Professor of Indian and Comparative Philosophy at Tel Aviv University in Israel. And we're speaking about a fascinating 2020 Bloomsbury publication, Daya Krishna and 20th Century Indian Philosophy. Daniel, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Who is this Daya Krishna? Who is this figure that your book is about, and how on earth did you end up writing about him?
Yeah. So who is Daya Krishna? First, of course, the book aims to answer the question. I mean, in a philosophical way. It's not an intellectual biography. It's a dialogue with one of the most interesting philosophers in the second half of the 20th century. And you must have noticed that I didn't say Indian philosophers in the second half of the 20th century, I said philosophers. So the book tries to create a dialogue with different aspects of his writing. And later I'll tell you what are the different aspects.
How did you end up studying this figure? Tell us a little bit about the backstory. How did that happen?
The backstory. So there are two backstories. One backstory is that I studied philosophy. I was an MA student at Tel Aviv University, a studio of student of philosophy. And one day by chance, I found a book at the library, which is not far from where I'm sitting right now, the Soraski Library, at the section of philosophy. I found a book titled Indian Philosophy, A Counter Perspective. And really by chance, I took the book out and started to read it. And there was something about the book, not only the content of the book, but the way it was written. And I was totally captured, you know, as a student of philosophy to something that you can call the questioning tone of Daya Krishna in the book. Looking backwards, I can try to theorize through Daya Krishna. Daya Krishna makes a distinction between thinking and thought. Thinking is something that constantly happens, and thought is the product of thinking. So you can feel, and I'm telling you, I'm telling the listeners, I'm actually recommending the book. You can hear Daya Krishna through the book. And I was totally captured, as I told you. And since I was young and naive and romantic to some extent, I still am, I thought to myself that next time that I'm in India, I'll try to find this man, this philosopher, this thinker. And not too long after, I found myself. I traveled to Jaipur, and I didn't know anything about that, Krishna. I mean, it was before, I mean, you know, the internet was what it is today, and I didn't write anything. I didn't write to him. I just came one day to his door in Jaipur. Actually, I went to the Department of Philosophy at the University of Rajasthan, and I asked for his address. And one day, I mean, that day in Jaipur, on a steamy August day, I knocked on his door, and he opened the door. I didn't know that he was already retired. I didn't know that he wrote something like 20 books. I really didn't know anything. My Sanskrit was bad. My Hindi was bad. Everything, I mean, it was just a coincidence. Or you can say that it was an accident. I saw that you're interested in the Mahabharata. You know that the Mahabharata, the narrative of the Mahabharata goes from one accident to another. So this was definitely an accident. And he opened the door, he said, yes, an old man wearing white kurta pajamas saying yes. And I was so, I was shy and excited. And then I said something like, I read your book. And he told me, which book? And I couldn't remember the title. So then he told me, look, I'm really busy. Come back in the evening. And he closed the door in my face. But I came back in the evening. And in truth, I stayed in Jaipur for almost 10 years. Daya Krishna became one of the supervisors of my PhD. And I became a part of an intellectual milieu that Daya Krishna was part of. And this book was in my mind for a very long time. Daya Krishna passed away in 2007, in October 2007. And it took me time, you know, to write the book as it is, as a philosophical dialogue with him, highlighting his projects. And I want to say two more things before I tell you something about these projects. The first thing is that the book is connected to a website that I did not create. It was created by two younger colleagues of mine, Do Miller from Tel Aviv University and Elis Kokero from Vienna and JNU. It's called Daya Krishna, the Open Library. And almost all of Daya Krishna's writings, both in English and in Hindi, are available on this website. Just type Daya Krishna on Google and probably Wikipedia will come first and the Open Library will come second. And the purpose of my book is to be a temptation, to work as a temptation for the readers to read the Daya Krishna firsthand. And now it is possible and available through the work of these younger colleagues, but also through the generosity of the family that gave the permission to put everything online. So Daya Krishna, the Open Library, that's where the real thing is. My book is just a window or a gate to Daya Krishna's writings.
It's fascinating.
So I tell you about the projects, about the three projects. So that Krishna wrote without end. I mean, the corpus is huge, and my book focuses on the last decade of his life, from the late 1990s until he passed away in 2007. The reason is both that I was there. And I had the privilege of discussing with him many of the writings that I'm engaging with in my book. But the second reason is that this was the most prolific decade of his writing life. So I think that it's not that I'm ignoring previous writings, but I think that, you know, that the most quote unquote mature in the best sense, in the philosophical sense. So the mature Daya Krishna can be seen or can be heard through his writings and lectures in this last decade. So Daya Krishna, his first book was published in 1955. It's actually his PhD's dissertation that was submitted to the University of Delhi. The title is The Nature of Philosophy. And it's basically a dialogue and a critique of European philosophy at the time. European philosophy, as it was read, you know, in Indian universities, he studied at the Hindu College, Delhi University, which was a wonderful academic institution. At the time, it's a good institution. Even today, as you know, we spoke about it before you started to record. And then Dayan Krishna dedicated 20, 30 years of his thinking and writing life to social and political philosophy. Dayan Krishna was theorizing socially and politically for India after the independence, and he did it in two ways. One way was to quote unquote bend or quote unquote calibrate Western theory for India. I'm borrowing the phrases to bend or to calibrate from Raghuram Raju. I don't know if you know the writings of Raghuram Raju, a really wonderful, and I'm using the word wonderful quite a lot. I'm not giving these compliments so easily. So if I'm saying wonderful, I really feel that Raghu is a wonderful thinker of our time. He's writing and teaching these days in Tirupati, South India. So Raghu is using this term to bend. What does it mean to bend Western theory or European theory for India? It means that it means two things. It means first that India has its own, you know, specific, unique features. And when we speak about society and polity, we think, of course, first, apropos society, about the caste system. And when we think about the polity, we think about decolonization. I mean, the political edge in Dayan Krishna's writing is very clear. And this is the reason that he cannot adopt, he cannot take, he cannot use Western theory. He needs to do something with Western theory. When Raghu explains the use of the verbs to calibrate or to bend, it's interesting. He says, I work in Tirupati. There are so many monuments in Tirupati. I don't need European monuments to be added to my, to quote unquote, my monuments. So I think that Dayan Krishna was doing this. He was quote unquote bending. And bending is also interesting because you have to be very gentle. If you are not gentle when you bend, even textually, philosophically, it might break. And the second trajectory Dayan Krishna is writing about social and political philosophy is to look for classical sources, for classical Indian sources, and primarily Kautilya's Artha Shastra. And this connects, I'm not letting you ask me anything, Raj. Maybe you want to say something. I just finished my sentence. I said Kautilya's Artha Shastra. But the point is that one of Dayan Krishna's lifelong, or not lifelong, but since he started to write and to think philosophically, so one of his lifelong or adult lifelong struggles was to free Indian philosophy from the jaws of spirituality, of religiousness, of moksha. For Dayan Krishna, Indian philosophy is not subordinated to the spiritual quest. It doesn't mean that Dayan Krishna was not interested in freedom or in freedoms, but the narrative that Western philosophy is rational and Indian philosophy or Indian culture or India at large is spiritual. He was trying to break this dichotomy, this binary, which unbelievably still prevails as I'm talking to you now. So the first project was theorizing socially and politically for the newly created India.
This dichotomy, as you wish, it's a conversation geared towards making aware the primary content of your book to encourage folks to engage it as they like. But as your book is centered around this fascinating figure, of course it makes sense to continue and talk about him and his work. Just a quick note, That dichotomy about which you speak is very much alive today. I teach online courses at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, and one of the courses I've taught since joining there every semester is a course on Hindu philosophy. And the characterizations of philosophy in India versus the West, the assumptions about each, this caricature is prevalent yet. So it is interesting and important work that he is engaging. Please continue.
Okay. So apropos the dichotomy, I just want to add that for Diocletian, there is no one center of Indian philosophy. There are several centers. And the centers that are as important for him are, first of all, philosophy of language, and secondly, political and social philosophy. So according to him, to focus on Indian philosophy only through the lens of spirituality is simply misleading. I was talking about his three projects. So the first project was the political social project. The second project that actually I came to Jaipur when he was working on the second and the third projects. The second project was rereading classical Indian sources with new eyes. Rereading classical Indian sources with new eyes. So the list of texts that Diocletiana was working on, I tried to explain what new eyes mean in a second. But Diocletiana wrote his own reading or interpretation for a long list of classical sources, for Shankara's Brahma Sutra Bhashya, meaning Shankara's commentary on the Brahma Sutra. And he wrote on the Nyaya Sutra, the Mimamsa Sutra, the Yoga Sutra. I don't know if the listeners are acquainted with the names. He wrote on the Bhagavata Purana, a very interesting article, which is called Listen, Raj. The title of the paper was, Did the Gopis Really Love Krishna? Did the Gopis Really Love Krishna? It's a paper on emotions, on philosophy and the emotions. And he's trying to connect Bhakti and Rasa. Bhakti is devotion, and Rasa is the aesthetic emotions. And the crux of the paper is that the gopis at some point did not need Krishna anymore. The object was the object of love became a hurdle for love as an abstract emotion. So but to write the paper, he was reading very closely the Bhagavata Purana. And I won't give the full, I mean, I can't give the full list of the texts that Diocletiana was reading closely. But I mentioned the last one. The last one was the Rig Veda. The last text that Diocletiana was working on in 2005, 6, 7, and actually passed away in the middle of his work on the Rig Veda. He called it the Jaipur edition of the Rig Veda. He was quite old at the time. He passed away at the age of 83. So think of an 80-year-old sharp mind sitting in Jaipur with scissors and the Rig Veda text, and literally cutting and pasting the most sacred text of the Indian or the Hindu tradition, whatever you want to call it. And he wanted to rearrange the Rig Veda according to the rishis, according not to the devtas, not to the divinities that the suktas, the songs, the hymns are addressed to, but according to the poets. And it was not published until today. I hope that it will be published. But he wanted to emphasize the let's call it the human dimension of the rishis and the rishikas, the male and the female poets of the Rig Veda, and the idea that we can play philosophically, we can play intellectually with the most sacred texts. I think that it's a very brave move, not only within the Indian context. I mean, take the Old Testament, the Bible, the Torah, take the Quran, take the New Testament, and cut it with scissors, or cut it with your you know, with your computer. I don't think that the traditions until today would be very open to such a move. But the idea was, you know, that when we speak today about reading, you know, apropos postmodern readings, we talk about opening the text. So Dhyakrishna was literally opening the text, you know, with scissors. So the second project is rereading classical Indian sources. Maybe I should give more examples. You know, Shankara, the biggest name of classical Indian philosophy, or at least one of the biggest names. I mean, the Buddhists might think that he's not the biggest name, or the Jainas or whoever. So one of the biggest names. We are talking about the 7th century or the 8th century. So Shankara writes a commentary to an earlier text called the Brahma Sutra, which is supposed to be a summary of the Upanishadic corpus. And Shankara writes a very interesting introduction to his commentary on that previous text. And you have to realize, I'm telling not Raj, I'm telling the listeners, you have to realize that when you write philosophy in India as a commentator in the 7th or 8th century, you are not as free as we are. We really free today? As we can be free today, as we try to be free today. So the introduction is the place where Shankara is free to write what he wants to write. He's not attached yet. He's not committed yet to the verses of the text that he's going to comment on. And Shankara writes on the notion of, as Raj knows, and he writes about the notion of adhyasa. Adhyasa is the mechanism of our gaze. This would be my explanation of the notion of adhyasa. But Dhyakrishna reads Shankara's first sentence in the introduction, where he's free to do what he wants. And Shankara writes, as every student of Indian philosophy would know, he says, the subject and the object are different. The subject and the object, the Vishaya, the subject, Vishayi, the subject and the object are different from one another like day and night. And Dhyakrishna thinks to himself, this is a strange opening for the Brahma Sutra of Hashya, because adhyasa, the error, adhyasa can also be translated, if you wish, as an error, as an epistemic, calm, existential error. So adhyasa, according to Shankara, the champion of Advaita, of non-duality, should be actually to make the distinction. If you make a distinction between I and you, between subject and object, this should be the error. But Shankara starts the introduction by saying, by saying that you have to make a distinction, that if you are not making the distinction, this is the error. So Dhyakrishna writes a paper called A Non-Advaitic Beginning to the Brahma Sutra of Hashya. And you know that he was reading these texts and he was raising these questions. And I don't really have, you know, the time to tell you about many interesting questions that he raises. He speaks, for example, about the notion of karma. The karma is not giving space for the other. The karma is a monadic jail, something like this. And you know, he was always raising these questions that no one raised before him. I always thought that there is some jadu, there is some magic in his glasses. And you know, I used to sneak when he left his desk. I used to sneak to his desk and wear and use his glasses to see if I can read the text and discover, you know, the new things that he discovered in these new texts. One of his books at that time is called the Vinaya Sutra, a new commentary on an old text, etc., etc. I can't give. I mean, more examples, of course, are in my book. And I want to speak briefly on the third project, the third big project of Dhyakrishna as a thinker, as a philosopher. The third project he titled the Samvad Project. Now, the word samvad or samvada in Sanskrit means dialogue, but the prefix sam means that it's a collaborative dialogue. It's not a, you know, it's not a debate. It's not a vada, you know, like the vada in King Janak's court in the third chapter of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, that everyone wants to win. And there's a prize, you know, for the winner, 1,000 cows, I don't know, decorated with gold. So Dakrishna was not interested in a competition. He was interested in a collaborative dialogue. And this was a dialogue between two groups of contemporary Indian philosophers. One group was academic professors, and the other group was the pandits, the classicists that think and write. Even then, it started in the mid-1980s, even today, that still think and write in Sanskrit. So these are two intellectual cultures that live side by side in India until today. I don't think that that many people read the pandits. You know, there are different stigmas on behalf of the pandits about the Western trained philosophers and the opposite stigmas by the academic professors about the pandits. And each of these groups is basically not interested in the work of the others. It's like two neighbors, door next to door, you know, two doors, and none of them knows what's happening in the next room. And Dayakrishna had the authority to bring together these two groups of philosophers, these two groups of thinkers. I don't know, you know, today, I don't know if you understand what I mean when I said that he had the authority. I mean, he was so famous at the time in India, and people appreciated his work. They wanted to collaborate with him. So no one could say no to this invitation. And the Samvad project was actually carried out through a series of meetings in different places in India. There is a sense of hospitality at the realm of ideas. The pandits were providing hospitality. Dayakrishna was providing hospitality to their thinking. Several publications came out of the Samvad meeting. Meetings, one of them is called Samvad, the first meeting in Pune, 1983, on philosophy of language. Later, there was a meeting at Brindavan on philosophy and the emotions. It came out, I mean, the protocols of the meetings, it was like a week-long seminar or event, intellectual event. So this came out in a book called Bhakti. There was another meeting on Kashmir Shaivism in Srinagar. There were other meetings. Again, I can't give the full list, but I'm writing about the Samvad project very elaborately in my book. Not about the story, I mean, where they met, and but about the contents of these meetings. And I'm highlighting two things. First, one of the most interesting for me texts that came out of these meetings, a paper in Sanskrit by Pandit Badrinath Shukla. I don't know, Raj, if you know Badrinath Shukla. He was a famous Navya Nayaika from Banaras. He wrote a paper following a meeting in Sarnath. He wrote a paper called Dehatmavad, or Dehatmavada, if you want, in Sanskrit. Deha Atma Vada. The body is the soul. The body is the Atman. It was translated to English by again, I'm using the word wonderful, by a wonderful contemporary Indian philosopher called Mukund Lark, who passed away this last August, a wonderful pandit, a wonderful translator, one of my teachers. So Mukundji, as we used to call him, translated Badrinath Shukla's Dehatmavad. And I'm discussing this paper. This paper is again available on this website, on dayakrishna.org, Dayakrishna, the open library. It is available both in Sanskrit and in the English translation of Mukunji. And I'm trying to open a window that Dayakrishna opened. Actually, I'm following his footsteps, a window to the Pandit way of thinking. What is the Pandit way of thinking? How do Pandits, I mean, of course, you cannot generalize, but still, in a general way, how do Pandits think and work and write? The paper that I'm talking about is written in the form of 32, I mean, it starts with a statement, the body is the soul, which is a wonderful statement because it raises a lot of objections. And Badrinath Shukla, Pandit Badrinath Shukla raises himself 32 objections to the statement, the body is the soul, and answers each of these objections one by one. And if you read them, I mean, I'm quoting some of them and I'm discussing some of them, but if you read Badrinath Shukla's paper, you come to realize that I don't have to call it the Pandit way of thinking or classicist way of thinking, of one of the classicist ways of thinking in India today, but also in the past, has to do with this dialogue. The philosopher has to write the Purva Pakshin, the objector. You have to write the objections to your own position. And I think that if you look deeply into Badrinath Shukla's paper, you realize that the philosopher is like a puppeteer working with two puppets. And I'm using the word puppeteer and puppets in a very that in a very positive sense. Is there a negative sense to puppeteer and puppets? I mean, he's using the Siddhantin and the Purva Pakshin, the asserter and the objector, as two voices. It's actually a duet that the philosopher is writing through two figures, two protagonists. And the last thing that I will say before I will let you ask me something is that I think, I mean, looking back at Dayakrishna's thinking, writing corpus, you can see that he himself was influenced by the work of the Pandits that he met, that he encountered, not for the first time, but very intimately, you can say, for the first time during the Samvad meetings. And I think that his writing developed in a slightly different way afterwards. He came to these meetings as a quote-unquote Western philosopher, as an Indian philosopher trained in Western philosophy. Again, I'm using generalizations I'm too schematic. Dayakrishna, I mean, knew Sanskrit. He studied Sanskrit in school. He has BA in Sanskrit. I mean, it's not the case that for the first time he met the Pandits during the Samvad project. But he was a modernist. He was trying to get out of to break out of the tradition, and it was in a way, you know, closing a circle, coming back to the tradition. And I think that this can be of interest, you know, not only in the Indian context. This is what happened in Europe. This is what happened in Israel. The Moderna and what happened, you know, after the Moderna. What happened after the modernist wave. Okay.
Would you say that he was successful in this conversational project? What would you say was the fruit? Would you say that this is a trajectory that, is there an impact to his methodology in this type of conversation?
Yeah. This is your first question, such a difficult question. I thought that you'd start with more easy questions. Whether Dayakrishna was successful. So I'll give you two answers. It's a difficult question about success in philosophy. My first answer is that sometimes philosophical failures are very fruitful. This would be my first answer. My second answer would go deeper, you know, into the question of what does it mean to be successful. Where are the pundits and the philosophers, or the pundits are also philosophers, where are the pundits and the professors today? Are there still meetings between between pundits and professors? Did Daya Krishna manage to break the ice? Did Daya Krishna succeed in creating something new in Indian philosophy, which is what he writes, you know, in the introduction to the first book that came out of the project that, that he aims to do? I don't know if he succeeded in this sense. Unfortunately, the negative, the horrible word partition is part of our lives in many ways. And I think that in this case, it's a matter of an intellectual partition that was created by and large by the intervention of the Britishers. You know that the Britishers supported financially newly created universities, which were teaching English and teaching European or English materials. And you know that the Sanskrit institutions became, they were no longer considered as the good institutions. And I think that Daya Krishna was trying to change the balance. Because the pundits are often perceived by the arrogant professors as dinosaurs, as repeating what was done in the medieval time, etc. And Daya Krishna manages to reveal the creativity of the pundits. And many questions. I gave the example of Badrinath Shukla's paper, "The Body is the Soul." It raises many questions beside the question of the body. The body, only an Israeli can say body. I mean, probably you're pronouncing the body or something like this. But still, remember that I'm an Israeli, that I'm not a Westerner, I'm not an Indian. I'm somewhere in between, right? The Middle East as a bridge between the so-called West and the subcontinent. So bringing back the body into the philosophical discourse. I mean, we talk so much about Merleau-Ponty, etc. Look at Badrinath Shukla, who never read, of course, Merleau-Ponty. And also the question about free thinking within the tradition and outside the tradition. Badrinath Shukla belonged to a school, to a darshana, to the Navian Yaya. I mean, often the schools look nowadays as some kind of a limitation. I don't want to say a jail, an intellectual jail, but Raj, that often the harshest criticism at the tradition comes from within the tradition itself. And I think that these points are becoming transparent through the Samvad project.
First of all, regarding your pronunciation, I happen to work and live in probably statistically the world's most diverse city, Toronto. So words are pronounced a variety of ways. And what better way to evidence that we are in the Kali Yuga than the internationally accepted language is the most textured and variegated and most difficult to learn, most irregular grammatically. In many ways, antithesis of the language of the gods, so to speak. So not to worry. Secondly, regarding my questions, they're always sort of naive, scenic route, generative questions rather than conclusive questions. And I always like to hear the perspective of people who have spent far more time on these topics than I have. So thank you for engaging that. Because in so doing, you point to the fact that this tension is very much alive and the struggle is very much there, both for heritage learners and for scholars and for the average lay person who doesn't know who to listen to, etc. So thank you very much. We are nearing the end of our time for today, but I wondered, I'm tempted to ask you a question about what you feel is the the takeaway of the contributions of this vast thinker, but that may well be a rabbit hole that we cannot escape from once we go down it. If you want to touch on that, you may, but we certainly want to know, what are you working on now? Like, are you still working on this figure? What's the next step after this book?
Yeah. Actually, my Daya book is part of a larger larger project that comes into expression in different papers and also in two books that I'm working on now, which is contemporary Indian philosophy. I think that usually when we think about India, we think about the classical Indian philosophy. And if you talk from within India, in Indian universities, you talk either about classical Indian philosophy or ancient Indian philosophy or about Western philosophy. But contemporary Indian philosophy or 20th century Indian philosophy is totally neglected. And I think that it's an interesting philosophical genre, not just a philosophical, a historical period, but actually a genre of philosophy in the sense that it corresponds simultaneously with classical sources and with Western sources. So it is interdisciplinary, it is inherently interdisciplinary. So if you really want to read Daya Krishna, you need to know something about classical sources in India, and you need to know something about Western philosophy. You need to know something about Marx. You need to know something about Freud. You need to know something about Shankara. You need to read the Upanishads. You need. And I think that we are now in a phase where we can think about global philosophy. Previously, we were talking about comparative philosophy. And by the way, usually the question which I'm asked when I talk about the book, I don't mention only Daya Krishna. I mention Daya Krishna and other interlocutors. I mention Kalidas Bhattacharya, Kesi Bhattacharya, Mukund Lat, Rajendra Swarup Bhatnagar. I mention living philosophers. We don't have to write only on dead philosophers. I mention a wonderful political philosopher like Gopal Guru, for example, in a chapter which is dedicated to social and political philosophy. So usually I'm asked, but where are Matilal and Mohanty? How come Bimal Krishna Matilal and Jain Mohanty are not part of your book? And Mohanty and Matilal became famous in the West. They were the fathers of I don't know if the fathers, but they were key figures in comparative philosophy. In discussing Indian philosophy on the one hand and Western philosophy on the other hand, and trying to get some recognition in the West for Indian philosophy, trying to show that Indian philosophy is as much philosophical as Western philosophy. But we are beyond this stage, I feel, I think, I believe. Right now, we can think about global philosophy through a thinker like Daya Krishna. Daya Krishna read everything. And having read everything, he writes independently, drawing on all these philosophical sources. So, but you asked me about what I'm doing right now. So I'm editing a book with two colleagues on the philosophy of Kesi Bhattacharya, the biggest name of Indian philosophy in the first half of the 20th century, Krishna Chandra Bhattacharya. Everyone knows his manifesto, Swaraj in Ideas. Very few read his full corpus. So one book is an edited volume on Kesi Bhattacharya. And the book that I'm writing these days is another dialogue, another intimate dialogue with another 20th century or the second half of the 20th century philosophical, Indian philosophical figure, Ramchandra Gandhi. I don't know did you read anything by Ramchandra Gandhi? Ramchandra Gandhi, or Ramubhai, as we used to call him, the grandson of the famous Mahatma, a very interesting commentator, both of the Mahatma and of classical Indian sources, trained in Oxford. So I'm trying to move forward with global philosophy.
Fascinating. We'll certainly have to have you back on the podcast when the volume is out. Thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Raj.
So for those of you listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Daniel Ravet, who is professor of Indian and comparative philosophy at Tel Aviv University in Israel. We've been speaking with him about his brand new Bloomsbury book, Dayakrishna and 20th Century Indian Philosophy, a book about this fascinating philosophical figure. Until next time, stay safe, keep reading, keep listening, and keep contemplating Indian philosophy. Take care.